All right, everybody, if you open up your Bibles, the text of Deuteronomy in the 19th and 20th chapter, that's the spot for our return to the text this evening, as we get ready to continue to listen to the closeout of what is the second sermon of Moses. It's part of the overall arc of Moses' work here in Deuteronomy, which includes, as we've said many times, and we'll repeat right now, three sermons, and then it closes with a song. That should be familiar enough for most of us, because usually you get one sermon and three songs. That's usually how the balance is. Now you can remember Deuteronomy and its structure fairly easily. Before we get into the text, though, let's take a moment, bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to be part of the kingdom of God. And it's our hope as servants of yours to grow our faith, to understand as best we can your will, and to be strong, zealous, and healthy servants in the kingdom. Please watch over our souls. Keep us safe from the danger and tribulation of the devil, and help us to understand the value of treasures stored in heaven. This prayer we offer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as we kind of break back into the text here and we open up Deuteronomy, we're looking at this cycle or series here in the middle section. We are right into chapter 20. We closed out some of the things in chapter 19, which is manslaughter, murder, and malice. The various attributes of personal relationship at the far extreme of awful, bad, it's not good. Moses slides into conduct in the time of conflict. Obviously, of the things that we see bracketing this particular chapter, many of these things are more far-reaching. They're after you've taken the land, after you've established the boundaries, after you've finished this course of action. This chapter here is going to really have some immediate application, like right now, right in this section. It comes on the heels of that large discussion of look at the prophet. You're looking for a prophet like me. The first layer is talking about immediate kingship leadership in Israel after Moses and Joshua turn the page. But the Old Testament picture here shows itself in Christ. We think about those chapters. That leads into this bigger discussion, which is relationships with your neighbors. And the terminology there is really structured heavily under the framework of what we already know. We've already talked about in the New Testament, where Jesus has dialogues about who is your neighbor, what is the greatest commandment, these interactions of expectation of the spiritual realm. And in all of those, there was a call back, much like you see in the Sermon on the Mount, and much like you see in the interplay between Jesus and the Pharisees, Jesus and the Sadducees and the lawyers and the scribes. They would ask a question. He would say, yeah, but either I say or it is written. So those are the two ways in which he answers. And many of those answers, they come straight from the heart of the preaching of Moses and the testimony of Deuteronomy. They're all pulling from that to get here. In this context here, we're looking specifically now at chapter 20, and there are going to be some very specific expectations in conflict. But here's the balance. When they're taking the land of Canaan, in the end, what is supposed to be the outcome for the inhabitants that reside in Canaan? Is anyone supposed to survive? The overall intention is not. Now, there's some reasons why. We don't see it discussed in Deuteronomy very much. We don't see it discussed in Leviticus precisely. But the context of this time frame, God is presenting the Canaanites to the Israelites as these people are idolatrous, rebellious, and by contrast, highly unholy. Their spiritual wickedness across a couple streams of their history justifies the course of action that God is taking with them. This is not Israel saying, we're kicking you off the land. This is God saying the land needs to be cleansed. and then it will be a land for Israel. And so that's the structure here. So some of the things that are laid out here aren't necessarily going to come into play immediately right in Canaan, but the concepts will. Like the specifics, not necessarily so much, but the concepts will certainly be there because you're still going to need to understand all these things. You notice like verse 10 as an illustration. Verse 10 of chapter 20, it says, "When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it." When you go look through Joshua, how many times do you see them offering peace? Is that something that goes down? In fact, you see a whole lot of the opposite. Let's just go in and take. When you go back in their history, how much parley takes back in a positive way with Israel before they come to the edge of Canaan? How do those dialogues take place and go down? You remember interactions with the nations around them when they would go like, "Hey, marry with our people, we'll marry with your people," because that's how peace is maintained. Did Israel ever say yes to any of that? Not really. And that caused more conflict. The structure here is we want peace. We want to offer terms of peace, to have a peaceful takeover in the general sense. Move forward to Israel after the conquest of Canaan period, especially when you get to Saul, because that's when things stabilized, and the David and Solomon, you actually see them doing that. You actually see them engaging in this practice. I mention that because we want to begin looking forward to that. When we get into Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, you're not going to see any of that. You're going to see what we might consider warlord-like behavior. And you'll kind of catch some of that when we get into Judges. Judges could easily be considered a text of Israelite warlords because they kind of behave that way. They're still saviors, they're still redeemers, but they're a different type. So that's kind of what you see there in the 20th chapter, is these precise instructions that deal with horses and chariots, that deal with God's role in the context of conflict, some of the exemptions that are offered for those who would serve in conflict and how that plays out. A term that you've probably heard before that we want to at least deal with a little bit. Ever heard anyone use the term, "It's a holy war," or "This is a holy war," or "the holy wars" historically? From thinking through that term, what does that imply? What do you gather from the idea that, hey, this is the holy wars? We'll talk about it historical. We're talking about medieval era, the Crusades. So around 800 AD-ish, all the way up to 1400 AD-ish. So what's the context for that historically? Right. It's conversion at the tip of the spear as an overarching theme. Now let me tell you a little bit more history if you've forgotten a lot of your history from that time frame like all of us do. It's the main reason and rationale for those wars was not at all about faith. It was they have land and property and value and we want it. And so we will zeal up our armies and our knights and our royalty, and they'll get excited about it. And they'll go off to a crusade to convert the heathens. But really, they were going to go down and take the land and expand the empire and make their space bigger. That created these conflicts of a holy war that was really more a crusade, that was actually more about a land war. Right? And that's another context here as well. The term holy war is a loaded phrase. Because then we come back to the text here, and someone will say, well, this is just ethnic cleansing. They didn't like them because of their ethnicity. That's not what takes place in the text. You remember from our earlier studies, that's not what's going on here. What's going on is this is punishment for spiritual rebellion, regardless of their ethnicity. Because in Canaan, in this region, there was not just one ethnic group. It was kind of a smorgasbord like it's always been. You also had strains of the remainders of the groups in the Old Testament identified as the sons of God that intermarried within the daughters of men. And so those family groups that are identified that way are part of this context. All right. So in this area, keep that in the back of your mind and then balance it back to this. Morally, in a sense of the theology around this, understand a couple of things as a balance. There is not an equivalency between the Crusades and these historical conflicts because they're dealing with two separate things. Yes, there is land in view, and yes, there is distinctly different religious practices in view. But unlike the Crusades, what the goal was for Israel really was a cleansed place, not because of ethnicity, but because of idolatry and immorality. It did not matter what was going on there. And then afterwards, unlike the Crusades, they weren't trying to subjugate those people. They just wanted them gone and their space to be made holy again as God defined and described it. That leads us into a nice section which is balanced to that. It goes from aspects of war in chapter 20 to 21, 22, and 23, which are reminders from our prior studies about sections in Leviticus that protect individuals who are, and we're going to use very generically, not so much weaker, but unprotected. That they don't have the capacity as an individual or as a group to provide for themselves any kind of real protection. And you see it beginning, and we're going to start reading now to kind of bring us into it, right into chapter 21, verse 1. And so let's read verses 1 through 9 together. We'll start kind of off kilter a little bit. Normally we start in the front or the back. We're going to start kind of in the middle this time. Bobby, would you read for us? And go ahead and read those 9 verses from verses 1 through 9. The chapter 21, that is, Bobby. Yeah, 21 verses 1 through 9. Thank you. Let's pause right there, Bobby. We'll finish out with verse 9. All right, so here's a group question. I think probably all of us are going to answer this yes. How many of you have either seen or read an unsolved murder historical thing? Everybody? Like historically read about those. How does that affect a community when there's a murder that's not solved? It's terrifying from an emotional standpoint. As an early middle schooler, there was a high school girl in my hometown that was found murdered in one of those pass-through gulches that go underneath the freeways, those concrete cylinders. And it took until about 2 years ago for them to figure out who was the individual. He had been a suspect, but they could not prove anything until some additional evidence was brought into play, some DNA evidence was connected, and he was finally convicted and finally sentenced. Traumatized that family, traumatized our community in many ways, and it left a scar emotionally in everybody. So one of the things you notice here is right as Israel is going in the land, they lay in place a principle that deals with something that actually historically is pretty common. We go through history, not everything gets solved. Nobody's Columbo in real life. Nobody is the best detectives that solve all the things. In reality, most cases are kind of soupy figuring out what happened. And even if somebody was there with the candlestick, with the camera, in the room that it happened, like you're playing Clue, even then, it's a complicated process in our current setting. And so, culturally, we kind of view these things a little bit differently, in part because of the size of our communities and the flexibility of some of those environments. But for Israel, that wasn't going to be the case. And so on the first layer, you can see the practical value of God creating an environment where there can be atonement taking place, because it gives a sense of relief. But there's two more layers to it. The first layer is the contextual obvious one. That is, the land is now soiled spiritually by the blood of evil endeavors. There needed to be a true spiritual atonement take place, not just an emotional one. And so there's that layer, and that's what you see there. But there's one more that I think is the most important one. I want you to think through the cycle in the text there, where atonement is being considered for no known criminal action. They don't know who did it. They know someone did something. They don't know who the criminal was. And so they created a sense of atonement for sin without identifying, wait for it, the sinner. Does that have any kind of relevance to maybe a New Testament concept? That kind of physical atonement. Just think of the process of the sacrifice of Christ, because that's the opposite. You have someone who did not know sin, who was offered up as atonement for those who knew their sin. And I just, as I'm reading through the text and getting ready for this class a while back, I'm reading through it, I'm going, okay, look at there. There's a nice little shadow anti-type kind of concept. It's not really that, but it's an echoing of a concept where atonement is going to be offered when there's no real victim, or there's no real spirit, there's a victim, but there's no real guilty party that you can find, even though you know this one's there. And so God is creating a place in Israel for them to understand that sometimes atonement takes place outside the context of what they would think would be the appropriate setting. And so think through this. Part of it also comes up in the practice. The practice of the atonement takes the model of, in essence, an execution, where the sacrifice being offered is, in essence, executed in the stead of the actual criminal. You go through the ideas. There's no altar, there's probably no broken blood of the skin, no blood flowing, but neck is broken, the sight in the situation is, there's an offering being extended. And really, that representation there really strengthens a picture of God caring for even the least, for the person who cannot see justice. Because the other end of that is the person's family or relatives or friends. They knew that God was participatory in there to the best that they could see and understand. I just thought that was a neat little illusion, if you will, of those two principles. The text continues into chapter 21, verses 10 through 14, to lay down some guidelines for an unprotected class. We really tried to emphasize strongly, and by the way, standard rules apply. You got questions, you got comments, don't know who you are, throw them out, raise your hands, interrupt me, because that gives me a chance to breathe. It's always a good thing. But in the Old Testament, and in the law in particular, it is far more egalitarian, equal in dispersion of male-female than our first reads often think about. There's a lot of emphasis on balanced punishment. There's a lot of emphasis on balanced opportunity. Even though there's distinction in roles in men and women, God made sure that everyone was cared for. And here you have, in the context of their physical conflict, women were highly at danger in physical confrontations. This is a culture that fights not with technology, but with hands and hand weapons. And the physicality of the male form is just stronger and more capable in that context on average. It just is. And yet God gave Israel some guidelines as to what would be appropriate. And at times, you see Israel in engaging in these. But these then afford a sense or a layer of protection. The text goes, verse 10, when you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to your wife, and you should bring you her home to your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails. You shall take off the clothes in which she was captured and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants. But if you shall not, but you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. Does that seem weird in our current culture? Like, that's strange. But think about it. In their culture, basically what they're saying is, you can't just dump her on the side of the road. If she wants to leave, she can leave. That's a different kind of shift from a culture in that context that said, no, I'm not like it. You're a slave. You're going to stay and serve. Now to you and I, we're like, that's horrible. She's lost the freedom to choose. There's bigger pictures in play. God's doing a few different things. Many of the times when God sends out Israel into conflict in the time of Saul, David, Solomon, they're going against nations that are also impacted by their own idolatry and rebellion. And you'll notice that there's a sense of purification that takes place in the actions that she's engaging in. Basically, if she stays, she is to be treated as a wife in Israel. So she would be given status, place, and wait for it, power. Just think about this, and we'll mention this a lot. Think through Genesis to now, how many of the matriarchs had as much influence on the outcome of the patriarchs as their daddies did? The answer is all of them. And in some cases, Mama had more influence on the outcome of the patriarchs than their daddies did too. We're not talking about whether they were right or wrong in their actions, because sometimes the answer is yes. They're both right and both wrong. But every single time, the matriarchs of those tribes had a strong influence. A hint forward, if you're looking for the idea of this maybe playing out fully, read 1 Kings chapters 3 through 6 and pay attention to Bathsheba and Solomon as they go with the prophet and how Solomon ends up being king. And we'll talk about that when we get there at the end of next year. But basically, the reasons that we see Solomon appointed to the throne are two. One, I got you, Bobby. One, God says so. And two, Bathsheba ensures it so. She goes and makes sure that the title is passed on to him instead of the oldest, which is Adonijah, and so on. Oh, yeah. Which is the other end of the spectrum about learned behavior. All these matriarchs and patriarchs have a history of political scheming to get their kids on the throne. Because I know that we kind of think of these people as heroes, but remember, they're people. God uses broken people to accomplish the history of His nations every single time. There's much more in common with us and them than we kind of sometimes gloss over when we look at the Old Testament as a series of kid-focused vacation Bible school stories where everyone's super perfect and super, super good and drawn with cartoons. Now, there's some real awfulness at times. All right, so from that text, it goes into the inheritance of the rights of the firstborn, something we talked about before, but I wanted to hone in on verses 18 through 21. That has to do with rebellious children. I want to identify something. Even today, in our culture, there's still a little hint of expectation that kids behave. To a degree, right? Because you can, I know that's the case, because if you bring some misbehaving kids to a quiet restaurant, how does everyone respond? Yeah, like, I'm not coming back here again. You know, so to a certain degree, even in our messed up culture. But on the other end, you ever see a kid being disobedient and people laughing at it, how cute it is? The powerful point here, from both a theological standpoint and a practical parental level standpoint, is God doesn't present that as a cute thing. Oh, how cute it is. It's no. Dude, you need to stop that. Israel is seen in their relationship to God in two ways. Much like the church is, it's seen as a bride, betrothed to Jehovah. But very often, it's a child to the Father who is in heaven. And childlike behavior is castigated, is complained about, it is identified as being the opposite of what is good. And we come into that text because we want to reread the passage again right now. Steve, you want to read for us? This is chapter 21, verses 18 through verse 21. All right, so here's something to put first on the table. The context here is not just a disobedient child per se. Oh, they're naughty, they didn't do their chores today. Nor, by the way, is this a child with harsh parents that have raised the standard so high that it's impossible for them to achieve. We know that because what is the criteria that Moses specifies? Drunkard and a glutton. Those are really obvious things, right? And by the way, for definition, everyone knows what a drunkard and a glutton is. Those are Old Testament wordies that we don't really use very much. Someone's got a serious drinking problem. Someone is, you know, an overindulger in all things. Glutton is not just limited per se to they eat a bunch of food. They overindulge in all things. They have no restraint. They lack the ability to stop themselves from doing stuff. You ever met anyone like that in either of those two categories? What's the life that surrounds them? Is it peaceful and calm? It's awful for everybody. If you've ever worked with children who come from homes that are in that context, those kids are ruined in some ways through parts of their lives. But the weight of the decision isn't placed on outsiders. It's powerful to note that the people who have to bring this to Israel are mom and dad. And the structure for solution here is pretty severe. You think about how, just on the first layer, because Moses is always teaching more than one thing in these sermons. On the first layer, did Moses have any experience with rebellious family members? Right? And, you know, he had been through a lot of this. And he had been present at the consequences for his own kinfolk in rebellion. So, like, he knew that. Next layer. Your own kid is the one in consideration. Or it's you. You're the rebellious child. We'll make it even a slightly different thing. And mom and dad come grab you. And they're taking you to the elders. Not these elders, those elders. Let's be correct here. That's rough, right? You ever see someone, and we'll use the easiest illustration, sitting outside the principal's office, sweating it? Oh, it's about to go down. And back in my day, at least in elementary school, the principal could still use the paddle. That paddle was about 2 feet long with holes for airspeed cut into it. It wouldn't be slowed down. At least that's what I told myself. And it hurts, by the way. Just in case any question, it does sting. And yes, I got paddled. In California, I earned it. So you think about that. That's something that's a light punishment. That's light affliction. Because the pain goes away. The memory doesn't, but the pain goes away. Eventually. Start raising the bar. Okay, now you've got a kid who's no longer really a kid anymore. This is basically a picture of a young man whose life is in such disarray that this is the last thing because of what it's doing to Israel. It's putting everybody in jeopardy. You ever encountered anyone who was at that point with their family? That what in our context, what needed to happen was for them to go to jail? That's the closest thing that we've got. Although going to jail for some means a short trip in jail and then there's deeper consequences. And so that's what you're seeing here on the practical edge. But on the spiritual edge, this is really about the holiness of Israel. It's not about the immediate punishment for the offender, which is just and appropriate in the context of everything because the overall arch is love your neighbor. And so think about it in the spiritual level of a family looking at their reprobate, rebellious son and thinking about their neighbors on the spiritual plane and fearful for what the impact of that child will be to others. That's a much more complicated application side, but it makes a little bit more sense in some way to kind of dig through the details. Plus, it helps us understand that rebellious kids probably existed in that century and survived the scourge of being stoned because they didn't clean their room. I mean, so it's really not that level of issue. This is much higher in its impact and situation. The text follows into verse 22 with this. And if a man has committed a crime punishable by death and he is put to death and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him on the same day. For a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. So as we had an atonement motif or picture earlier, now we have a condemnation for the hanged man. Again, is there anything like that in the New Testament, Old Testament that has any kind of relevancy? Any Bible stories? Right. I mean, everyone's like, well, I can think of a few. Right, there's some, they held to those principles in the first century when Christ got there. And so when you have the spear to the side, the check that he's dead, and they came and they got the body and they laid him to rest, in part because of the impetus to do so. There is a reason why they moved again to still maintain the holiness of the land. So in that bigger picture of things, now we have, again, Deuteronomy coming back into play to giving us a little hint of understanding, because this is for a criminal, someone justifiably, appropriately executed for their crimes. And Jesus doesn't really fit that, does he? To the Jews, they kind of thought he did, until they wisened up a few days later, 50 days. And he had not. And some of them knew and still had no way to stop. The disciples knew, some of the ruling class knew, but they went along with the desires of the large crowd. So in those settings, in that place, we see a balance of justice that goes from some conflict issues, unsolved murders, all the way into consequences of actual criminal behavior or intended criminal behavior. And then it moves into chapter 22, that is, and you encounter kind of a shift, but not so much a huge one. Chapter 22 begins a section that talks about the care for life that is around you. One of the things that I think is really important for us to see also in the Old Testament is that God made a strong case that everything that was living was precious. And it's really always been that way. Go back to the garden. What are the garden rules? There's not many of them, but what are the garden rules? It's a short list. There's no commandments. Plural. Don't eat that fruit. Tend the garden. There are living things in there that require the care and attention of man. Like, he had to take care of that. Day one, I'm Adam. I got to take care of this because God cares about it. Moves forward to post-garden and the children of Adam and Eve. The blood cries out. Blood now is an issue. Go forward in the law and in the way in which God expects them to care for the land that is Israel, the maintenance of the land, the way in which the crops are to be cared for, the way in which even when you harvest an animal for food under the law, all of those things had prescribed expectations. Do it this way, for this is a holy land and a holy place. And the memory point for me has always been, this is the way I remember it, that the land of Israel is more holy than the man's hand who reaches up to steady the ark. It would have been better for it to fall in the dirt and for him to touch it with his hand. That's how I remember the concept. I mean, it also would have been better for it to fall in the dirt. He would have been fine, in theory. That picture, though, drives us to this text here, and we start seeing some of the various instructions that Moses goes over in a public way. It says here, beginning verse 1, "You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and ignore them." Raise your hand if you've ever been on the freeway somewhere and you've seen someone on the side of the way broken down and you wonder what you're going to do. Do we stop or do we go? Bobby, you've done that. I know I've done it. We turn our fear factor on. I'm not so sure about this. And if I have the kids with me, I'm not stopping. Especially when they're little. I'm not even stopping necessarily when they're older because they're knuckleheads. And they'll start doing stuff without I'm not looking. So you have a concern there issue. That's semi-legitimate. But now you see a stray dog. Stray pet. You going to go rescue that pet? We don't really do that. I do. I've chased dogs in our neighborhood. Jill's watched me do it. It's kind of hilarious. The kids have watched me do it because the dogs are much faster than I am, even the little tiny ones. It's basically like a combination of Barney Fife and the Three Stooges. is what it looks like. But that's kind of what you're seeing in the text here. If you see your neighbor's, your brother's ox wandering off, go get it. Now here's the balance of the text. Here's the other end of it. It's the Sabbath, and I've got an ox in the ditch. Do I go rescue it? What did the Pharisee and the Sadducee want the answer to be?
Oh, no, no, we would never go rescue that ox on the Sabbath. No way. That ox, we can't do any work on the Sabbath.
God, all the way back, not only in Deuteronomy, but also in Exodus, is like, go save the ox. Go on a rescue mission for the ox, your friend's ox, your brother's ox. Save it. Go rescue it. Part of that has to do very clearly in the value of it. An ox actually is livelihood to a certain degree. But God doesn't specify that as why. He doesn't say save it because it's worth a lot. You're saving their Ferrari. You're saving their Maserati. You're saving their $300,000 whatever. You're saving their ox. God says it's important to do so, to gather it in. He goes on and says in the text, as it reads forward, you shall take them back to your brother. And if you do not live near and you do not know who he is, you shall bring it home to your house and it will stay with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. Either you shall do the same with his donkey or with his garment or any lost thing of your brother's, which he loses and you find. You may not ignore it. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen down by the way and ignore them. In a very absolute sense, it says, you shall help him to lift them up again. Now, this falls, hopefully, into the category of the things, once seen, you'll never unsee it. So now, every single time when you're thinking about the conversation that Jesus has with the ox in the ditch, both from the literary standpoints, the admonition standpoints, the go-rescue standpoints, this is part of the heart of it. And think about how much care is given to an ox, to a donkey, to a garment. I found this. Finders, keepers, losers, weepers. That's the kid line, right? I found this out here. Doesn't have anybody's name on it, and it's my size. This is the best day ever. When the actual text here for the Israelite is, I found it. Let's hold it until someone comes get it. Think about it. Basically, in part, this is Israeli lost and found. Canaanite lost and found. You hold on to it and they come looking for it. That means you can't butcher it. You can't starve it. You can't sell it. You got to just feed it. How much does an ox eat? I really don't know, but he probably uses more than I do. Because he's a lot bigger than me, right? Now you're obligated by God to care for it until it works out. Until the solution comes. Or if it's just a garment. That shows you a level of care, connection, commitment, and compassion that really is the heart of the terms that are in that conversation. Love your neighbor as yourself. Because if that was your ox, your coat, your donkey, and you lost it, you want it back, right? You ever had someone return something to you that you thought was lost? It's like the best day ever. It's like you're getting a double gift. That's in the heart of the text here. That's in the heart of Deuteronomy, and it should echo every time we think about that concept. And since class is over, we'll close here, but remember,